think what Andrew read to us gives us the uniqueness of Jesus' suffering. The other things he went through, other people have experienced similar things. They've experienced rejection, abandonment by their friends, torture, and so on. But this is unique. And I think there are two places where we see something of the soul of Jesus and his suffering. One is in the Garden of Gethsemane, and one is when he's hanging on the cross. And so in the Garden of Gethsemane, he's struggling. And he took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death." There was a huge struggle before the cross as he looked forward to what was ahead, taking on the sin of the world. Here is the perfect one taking your sin, my sin, the sin of the world. He must have shuddered as he thought about that. Here is the righteous one going to experience the horror of hell. A famous American theologian in the 18th century, Jonathan Edwards, he put it like this, that in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus had a near view of that furnace of wrath into which he was to be cast. He was brought to the mouth of the furnace that he might look into it and stand and view its raging flames and see the glowings of its heat, that he might know where he was going and what he was about to suffer. There are two things that render Christ's love wonderful. One, that he should be willing to endure sufferings that were so great. And two, that he should be willing to endure them to make atonement for wickedness that was so great. But in order to its being properly said, Christ of his own act and choice endured sufferings that were so great, it was necessary that he should have an extraordinary sense how great these sufferings were to be before he endured them. And so he suffers there in the garden. And then as he's hanging on the cross, he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" There is the utter abandonment at the cross. Just as in his life, he had experienced unique fellowship with the Father and internal fellowship with the Father, so in his death, there was unique abandonment by God. Why? Why is he willing to go through such suffering, to experience the horrors of hell, to face God's wrath poured out on him? Why is he willing to do that? Well, it's the only way to save us. There's no other way. And even in the mocking of the people, there is the answer. So if you look at verse 31 of chapter 15, when the people are mocking him, "In the same way the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself." Well, he could have, but if he had done that, you and I wouldn't experience salvation. He had to go through that suffering in order to save you and me. And he did it to open the way to God. And so even as he dies, we read, "The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, 'Surely this man was the Son of God.'" To open the way to God, even for Gentiles. Psalm 22 opens with, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" And that's what Jesus cries out as he's on the cross. Psalm 22 finishes with, "People from every nation will bow down before him." And that's what happens because of the cross. Today there are people in every nation of the world who are bowing down before Jesus because he was willing to suffer. One of the things that struck me as I was reading through Mark 14 and 15 is some of the responses to Jesus. And so at the beginning of chapter 14, you have this wonderful story of this woman who comes with her expensive perfume, more than a year's worth. Now, I don't know what the equivalent would be, whether it's 12,000 pounds, 15,000 pounds worth of perfume. And she comes and she pours it on Jesus because of her extravagant, loving devotion to him. She didn't hold back in any way. Just a wonderful act of devotion, thankfulness to Jesus. And that to me speaks of God does not forget any act of loving devotion that you and I commit to him. As we act out of love for him, he remembers it. And in fact, Jesus said, this story is going to be told all over the world. And we've read it today, or we read it in Mark's gospel. So that's one response. The second response is the religious leaders who felt threatened by Jesus. They were determined to kill him. They weren't willing to submit to him, to listen to him. They weren't willing to change their thinking or their behavior. They claimed to be following God, but they were not prepared for God to rule over their lives. Here is the Messiah, God's King, coming, and they will not submit to him. They reject him. A third response is feeling disappointed by Jesus. And Judas was disappointed. I think when he joined up as one of the 12, he was excited by what was about to come. And yet, as Jesus comes closer, he begins talking about his death, he begins to feel, this isn't what I signed up for. Jesus is not delivering what I really want. These are my desires, and Jesus is not delivering them. So he's feeling disappointed, and he betrays Jesus. You know, sometimes we can do that by the way we act. We say we are followers of Jesus, and yet somehow there's that feeling of disappointment with Jesus. He doesn't deliver what we were hoping. And so in the way we act, we betray him. And then fourthly, confident in our own strength. That's what Peter felt, but the other disciples as well. Jesus said, the sheep will be scattered. You'll all leave me. And Peter says, no, no. I'll stay with you even if it costs me my life. And the other disciples say the same. And then when it comes to it, they all run away. They forsake. Someone has said, faith without witness is fragile. Private faith, but public silence, is vulnerable to public denial. It's easy to, in a group like this, to say, yes, I will follow Jesus. And then we get out there and we're faced with different situations and we deny Jesus. The communion that we've just celebrated reminds us of two things. First of all, Christ's extravagant, overflowing, sacrificial love. He gave himself totally for us. Surely our only right response is that we should give everything to him. Tony said, we were not going to take up an offering here, but surely our response today should be, Lord Jesus, here is my life. Here are my gifts. Here's my money. Here's my time. Here's everything I have. It belongs to you. Surely that's the only right response for us. And we put away any rivals to that, to Jesus. Longing for wealth and achievement and success and fame and all the rest of it, we give it to Jesus. But the second thing we see in the communion, I believe, is Jesus' faithful commitment to us. Just listen to chapter 14, verse 28, when Jesus was saying, you're all going to leave me. And he says, but after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. He knows what they're going to do, but he knows what's ahead. There's hope. In those words, there is hope. You're going to fail, but there's forgiveness. There's a new start. I'm going to meet you. And we know what happened with Peter. He denied Jesus and he wept bitterly. And after the resurrection, Jesus meets especially with Peter. And he experiences the forgiveness and a new start. And so our trust is not in our wisdom. It's not in our strength. It's not in our determination. Our trust is in his faithfulness, in his grace, in his strength, in his determination to keep us going to the end. And so let's be those who open ourselves to God's love. We've thought about his love today. He so loved the world that he gave his son. Let's open ourselves to his love, and let's return that love with all our heart, all our being.